From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Rescue workers on the scene of that condominium collapse in Surfside, Florida, are still holding out hope that survivors can be found. But today, Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava said the death toll has risen to 10, with 151 people still unaccounted for.
There is going to be a thorough and full investigation of what led to this tragic event. We are going to get to the bottom of what happened here.
In a report in 2018, an engineer warned about serious structural problems, one of the developments we're following. But let's hear now from a person who's helping others in need. He wears many hats. Yonah Lunger is chaplain for the city of North Miami Beach. He's a vice president of the local Chamber of Commerce, and he's founder of the nonprofit Hesed, which helps people in need during a crisis. And Yonah, people very much in need now. What are you hearing?
Well, I would say we're very much in need of two things. One, that the people can help. The other one, that no one can help. What people can help is prayer. What no one can help is time. Yeah. Time is of the essence. It's unknown as to what's in there still, meaning as far as remains or whole bodies or whatever there may be. We have the best first responders that's on the ground. Miami-Dade Fire Rescue, Urban Rescue, they have special task forces. They are simply amazing. They have a special task force team that flew in from Mexico. And then there's another team, Urban Search and Rescue. They travel from Israel. One would say they're here because, yes, there are probably a vast majority of the tenants or landlords or owners who live there occupied are of the Orthodox Jewish faith. But the answer is they're here because there's a need.
Yonah, I have to ask, did you know anyone in the building who's missing or had escaped?
Yes, I know several people. Unfortunately, they're still missing. One of them is a very, very good friend of mine. She got married 7.5 weeks ago to a doctor. She worked for Aventura Hospital, and she's one of those who didn't report back to work and missing.
Well, what are you hearing from people? I mean, everybody knew somebody. It's a small area. So there's this palpable grief and fear about what, you know, they're going to hear next. But I also mentioned the report, the consultant that found evidence of major structural damage to a concrete slab below the pool deck, cracking, crumbling of beams and columns in the parking garage, which holds the building up. There's new reporting of a man who said he was on the phone with his wife in the building. She was looking out her balcony and said the pool just disappeared, like a sinkhole had opened up and then the line cut. She's now missing. Presumably that's when the building fell. We know buildings over 40 years are being ordered to get inspections, but nothing seems certain, it would seem. I mean, are people moving out of buildings that didn't fall?
We have to go back to the part where the history of this building, 1981. There's a developer who died in 2014. His name was Nathan Reber. He was a fugitive from Canada who evaded taxes for phony construction work, according to a new report of the Washington Post.
Well, the Washington Post was reporting this, but I'm imagining this is what's happening all over the city. People are wondering, what happened here? You know, was this there? The New York Times is also quoting structural engineers who say it could have been in the construction, faulty construction. They don't know. You know, there are other buildings that might just be corroded from storm surge and salt water, which is corrosive. Are you hearing these kinds of fears from people coming to you for help or just even friends? Are you hearing this?
Well, obviously, people are always having all kinds, you know, when something happens like 9/11, people were scared of high rise, people were scared of large places. There's not enough tears left in literally in the bank of the eyes, so to speak, where you see families crying and you're just there and you have nothing to say. You just hold them, support them, give them support and give them more support. But on the other hand, you get these happy tears. These happy emotions where you see hundreds of every religion. People just show up there with bags. They went to Costco. They spent a couple of hundred bucks on socks. Unfortunately, it takes a disaster to show the humankind, the beauty of the people. And then you have people who live in the islands, who live in the areas and surrounding, who come by on Friday and says, I have 5 bedrooms left in my house. It's just me and my husband. Please, anybody, first responders, you need to sleep over. Family members, you need to sleep over. Here, just put me on the list. There are no words. Honestly, there simply are no words how beautiful the human race is. And I'm talking about my phone doesn't stop.
That does the heart good. Yona Lunger, yes. Chaplain for the city of North Miami Beach, vice president of the local chamber of commerce and founder of the nonprofit HESED, which helps people in need during a crisis. We'll link you at hereandnow.org. Yona, thanks, and our best wishes, prayers to you.
Thank you.
A new study published today in the journal Nature adds to the growing body of evidence that immunity against the coronavirus lasts for years and possibly even a lifetime for people who get the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines. Good news, that's not going to matter if you don't get the shot, because the Delta variant of the coronavirus is sweeping through communities with low vaccine rates. More cases per capita have been reported in Missouri over the past week than in any other state. Angela Rasmussen is a virologist at the Vaccine and Infectious Disease Organization at the University of Saskatchewan. Angela, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
COVID hospitalizations and deaths are up in Missouri and other states, and the number of new cases there is similar to what was happening back in February. So I just want to start with a statement of fact that this pandemic is not over.
No, absolutely not. The pandemic is not over. And I think that we've been lulled into a false sense of security because communities that do have high vaccination rates have seen cases decline precipitously. But as the summer gets hotter in communities where there are low vaccination rates, people are going to be going inside into the air-conditioned environment to get out of that summer heat. And if there's not a high vaccination rate, that creates a situation that is really conducive to the virus spreading.
More on that in just a minute. But what do we need to know about this study that I mentioned, that vaccine immunity could last for many years or even maybe a lifetime?
Well, it's very, very encouraging. And it just reinforces how really we lucked out with these fantastic mRNA vaccines. We really didn't know how long we could expect immunity to last from any of these vaccines, because that was one of the things we sacrificed to make sure that we could get them out onto the market quickly. But this study, although it was very small, does suggest that these vaccines are producing really potent memory immune responses. Now, it remains to be seen whether or not those responses will translate into protection in the real world, but it's a very, very good sign.
What are you seeing happen with the Delta variant? And that is what many public health officials say is responsible for these new cases that we were talking about in Missouri and elsewhere.
Well, the Delta variant is very concerning because of all the variants of concern that have emerged, Delta appears to be the most transmissible by far. And while the jury is still out on whether it's more pathogenic, meaning that it is more likely to make you very, very sick, we know for a fact that it spreads very, very easily among unvaccinated people. Now, the good news with the Delta variant is that people who have been fully vaccinated do have really significant protection against Delta. But in people who are unvaccinated or partially vaccinated, they themselves are great targets for Delta to spread.
But as we've been talking about, so many communities are not getting fully vaccinated. Douglas County, Missouri, only 15% of its residents are fully vaccinated, and the numbers are similarly low in different parts of the South, often conservative places, rural areas. How concerning are those discrepancies to you?
Those discrepancies are extremely concerning, and I am not convinced that those low vaccination rates are just because of vaccine hesitancy or because people don't believe in vaccines or don't trust the vaccines. I think in many cases, in many parts of the United States, we are still experiencing a situation in which people are not getting access to the vaccines. If people have to drive hours, if they have to go far out of their way to get the vaccines, they're going to be less likely to get them. So we really do need to do a better job, not only at answering people's questions and concerns about the vaccines, but actually getting the vaccines to these people, meeting them where they are.
Hmm. Do you think those discrepancies are baked in at this point? In other words, do you think we could do a better job?
I absolutely think we could do a better job. Many of the people who do have concerns about vaccines, and that's why they're not getting them, really could have those concerns addressed by trusted members of their communities, by physicians. We need to do a better job at addressing people, at engaging with them and answering these questions. We also, as I said, need to do a better job of physically bringing the vaccines into these communities. In many rural places, there is not a convenient drugstore or mass vaccination site that you can go to that's right down the street. We really do need to be bringing these vaccines to people and putting them in their arms.
Angela Rasmussen is a virologist at the Vaccine and Infectious Disease Organization at the University of Saskatchewan. Thanks so much for your insights, as always.
Thanks, Peter.
That's the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, which in July resumes concerts in front of an actual audience. Concerts that will be the swan song for Maestra Marin Alsop, the first woman to lead a major North American orchestra, who steps down in August after 14 years. But the baton in Baltimore is in good hands. Jonathan Rush was 25 last year when he was named assistant conductor of the Baltimore Symphony. He's one of the up-and-coming conductors of color in the classical world, up-and-coming conductors, period. And we want to hear what's on his summer playlist. Jonathan, welcome.
Hey, how are you?
Well, I'm better now. We're going to hear some more classical music. But it comes after this year.
Oh, well, this past year has definitely been a ride for me, a roller coaster ride, if I will. When it started out, I was sitting at home in Connecticut, pretty much doing nothing, you know, and I was actually very concerned. I didn't think I would have a career. I didn't know how this whole pandemic would turn out. But I'm just so grateful, though. I got a call from the Baltimore Symphony. You know, they knew me because I had a concert with them back in February, right before the pandemic. And it got such great reviews, and the orchestra members were raving about it, that the artistic staff decided to reach out to me and say, hey, Jonathan, look, the musicians love you. We love you. We're trying to do this new online series called BSO Sessions. We're going to need an assistant conductor. So how do you feel about joining our staff without audition, without anything? They just hired me. And then my world just completely flipped from doing no conducting at all. When September of 2020 hit, I was conducting every single week.
Yeah, I mean, definitely it's something that worked out. I want to ask you so many things. Let's listen to some of your music. Topping your playlist, Fate Now Conquers, Carlos Simon. Let's listen.
Well, I just love really what the piece is about, you know, Fate Now Conquers, which is actually taken from a journal entry that Beethoven had written. But with Fate Now Conquers, you know, the composer Carlos Simon always talks about how unpredictable fate is. It's something that we think we have control over, but we don't. And the music reflects that with, you know, these jabs of like loud music. You can hear the brass, bump it down. You know, those jabs that you hear inside the music, it's something so unexpected. And then you have all of this fast moving stuff happening inside the strings. And then even later on, they're doing all these arpeggios with the winds going up and down to just let you know of how unpredictable and unexpected, you know, fate can be.
And it was inspired, we understand, by Beethoven's struggle against obstacles, including deafness. And here we come out of a pandemic. So it seems perfect for the moment. What else does an assistant conductor do?
So typically, besides conducting regularly in a situation like I was in, an assistant conductor also serves as the cover conductor, usually known as like an understudy to whatever conductor is in front of the orchestra. So while they're rehearsing, I'm sitting inside the hall listening for balance, you know, giving them notes, taking notes to tell the conductor whether or not, you know, the flutes need to come down or, you know, this part wasn't necessarily in tune. You know, I'm just the extra ear that they have. The pandemic was different. Like I said, I was conducting every week. They needed extra conductors to come, you know, take up the load. And so I was glad to be a part of that team.
And we know that it's been hard to get pieces by women and women of color into the classical canon. And here's one of your favorites. It's Coincident Dances by Jesse Montgomery. Let's listen.
I mean, it's just, there's so much going on inside of this piece. And I love it because you're not just hearing, you know, one style of music, but you're hearing all of these different styles and genres of music. And so even with that trumpet solo, I kind of got an idea. And I mean, Jessie writes about this too in her program notes, you know, Latin jazz music. And she talks about how this piece, when you're walking through the city of New York, you never know what you're going to encounter. You know, you might walk and you might hear Latin jazz music playing out of somebody's car while you're listening to R&B. It's an experiment, really, for her to just mash up all these different styles. That's how you get Coincident Dances. And I just think it's absolutely incredible.
And Jessie Montgomery, a Black woman of 40. So it's got that youth in it, too. I'm remembering that Maren Alsop was inspired by Leonard Bernstein when she was just a child, learned from him. You were also taught by Maren Alsop before you became assistant conductor. What did you learn from her?
I think the biggest thing that I learned from Maren was it is 100% okay for me to be myself. And everything that I have to offer is fine. You know, usually inside the conducting world, they expect you to look a certain way and they expect you to act a certain way and to conduct a certain way. But with Maren, she never wanted cookie cutter students. So she never wanted us to look like her. She wanted Jonathan to conduct like Jonathan. And then part of what she was doing was helping refine my conducting to make sure that what I was doing was also clear to the musicians.
You're also music director at the Ebenezer Temple United Holy Church near where you grew up in Hartford, Connecticut. And so there's some gospel on your summer playlist. Let's listen.
I'll never be more loved than I am right now. Wasn't holding you up, so there's nothing I can do to let you down. It doesn't take a trophy to make you proud. I'll never be more loved than I am right now.
That's Gyra, which loosely translates as Abundance, by Maverick City Music, a contemporary worship music collective and record label based in Atlanta, Georgia. As we talked to Jonathan Rush, assistant conductor for the Baltimore Orchestra, and that's one of his picks for the summer. This reminds me of an interview with Washington Post classical music critic Michael Andor Broder that Maren Alsop did, in which she reminded him not only will there be no other female conductors in a major American orchestra when she steps down, accent on major, there's some smaller orchestras. There will be no American conductors in a major American orchestra when she steps down. Yeah. And so I'm thinking presumably no conductors who grew up in a church with American gospel. What do you think you bring to the orchestra?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think one of the biggest things that I'm able to bring is just something so different, you know? Yes, I do have some classical training, but that wasn't the bulk. You know, my musical foundation was gospel music. That's where I learned how to play the piano. I learned how to play by ear. That is my thing, to be able to, you know, not just bring you classical, but when I'm up there conducting or when I'm performing, you're going to get the soul that I have when I'm, you know, directing my gospel choir, or the soul that I have when I'm singing gospel music on top of all of the, you know, joy that comes when I'm conducting classical music. You're going to get the whole musical world that makes up Jonathan Rush rather than just, you know, classical Jonathan. I think even a lot of people my age, you know, they have to offer just a difference. They're bringing new insight and they're bringing new ideas and new experiences the way we were brought up musically is completely different than the way our teachers and their teachers were brought up. And so that's what, you know, I would like other orchestras and other people to acknowledge and to see, you know, when it is our time to actually, you know, step up on the stage. I want them to see that, hey, we have something to offer, and it's completely different.
Well, and back to your playlist for the summer. Here's Petite Suite de Concert by, I'm sure I mauled that, by Samuel Coleridge Taylor. This is a black Englishman from the early 1900s. We've been hearing a lot more of Samuel Coleridge Taylor's music on classical radio just this past year.
Number one, I just think it's an absolutely beautiful piece. But with Coleridge Taylor, you know, he's trying to combine the Afro style with Western classical music style. Kind of similar to how Brahms did, you know, Hungarian music to classical music. That's kind of what Coleridge Taylor was doing for Afro-Cuban music. I'm appalled at the fact that, you know, Coleridge Taylor didn't get as much attention because it's genius stuff.
Jonathan Rush, the New York Times recently had a headline that read something like, orchestras looking for conductors, look no further than your assistant conductors. Where do you think you are? How would you describe Jonathan Rush in this moment?
Honestly, I think that I do have something to offer, but then I still have things to learn. But I plan on just having some fun, you know, listening to all my music and just making sure, you know, when people do see me, that they're getting all of me and they're getting, you know, 100, they're getting authentic Jonathan.
Well, Jonathan Rush, assistant conductor of the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Oh, you know, thank you for having me. I'm so honored to be here.
The first podcast series to ever win a Pulitzer Prize, NPR's No Compromise.
We dive into the political movement that's driving extreme gun rights activism and more. I'm Chris Haxel.
And I'm Lisa Hagen. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Starting July 15th, millions of American families will get an injection of cash into their bank accounts. It is the new enhanced child tax credit, part of the American Rescue Plan, which President Biden signed in March to help with pandemic relief. Let's bring in Jill Schlesinger with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So how much is that new credit and who qualifies?
Well, the government increased the amount from $2,000, which is where it was, up to $3,600 for anyone who has kids under age 6, $3,000 for other children who are between 6 and 17 years old. And in terms of who qualifies, well, obviously you have to have a kid, but, you know, the kid might be born later this year, so it's till December 31st of this year. You've got to make below certain threshold amounts, $75,000 or less if you're single, $150,000 or less if you're married filing jointly, $112,500 or less if you're filing as head of household. And there's a little squish room, another $20,000 of income will allow you to get some part of the credit, not the whole thing.
All right. Well, clearly lawmakers, when they passed this months ago, they were trying to give American families an injection of cash at this precarious time. But, you know, the economy is now revving back up again. Do you think that the need is still there, especially for some of those higher income families?
Well, I guess for the higher income families, maybe not. But remember that this tax credit is going to lift millions of Americans. And, you know, I've seen a lot of different numbers, but it's just an enormous number, tens of millions of people up out of this precarious situation, many of whom would be on poverty levels. So I think that this was the best that they could do, knowing what they knew back in March, right? They were trying to pass a law in anticipation of what would happen. So, you know, indeed, some of the wealthier folks who might be able to claim parts of the credit, they may not need it. But I think for most, the vast majority of people who are getting it, they certainly can use a tax credit for their kids.
And just briefly, to be clear, you don't have to do much of anything to get this credit, right? It just shows up in your account if you filed taxes last year?
Yes, exactly. The IRS has a bunch of information based on 2019 or 2020 federal income tax returns. So about, I think, 36, 39 million households got letters saying, hey, we think from the IRS, Uncle Sam says, hey, we think you're due for this. I will say that if your income is different, your address is different, your bank account is different, your number of kids has changed since then, there is a really neat tool on the IRS website, irs.gov. It's called the Child Tax Credit Update Portal. So you'd want to update information there.
And just before I let you go, the reason we're talking about this now is that today is the last day to opt out of the credit. You can just opt out. But why would anyone want to do that?
Well, I mean, first of all, there's a lot of people who are making more money this year than they did last year. And so while the IRS might think you're entitled to it, you may not. You may know already I'm making more money. I won't be entitled to this. The IRS has an unenrolled tool. So if you don't want to owe the money back to Uncle Sam when you file next spring, you may want to unenroll. If you're not sure, just unenroll, because if you do actually qualify, you can get it when you file next spring.
I see. That is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Thank you very much.
Take care.
Over the last year, beginning with COVID survivor Diana Barrett, who founded the group Survivors Corps, we've reported on COVID long haulers, people whose symptoms from brain fog to devastating illness linger or get worse after they're cleared of the infection. But researchers are only beginning to study one of its most devastating outcomes, suicide. In a recent op-ed in the online journal MedPage, the director of epidemiology for the St. Louis Veterans Affairs Healthcare System writes that long haulers are prone to depression, anxiety, and neurological disorders. We must deal with this now to prevent it from ballooning into a suicide crisis. Now, we're going to start and end this next conversation with an offering. If this is hitting home, the number to the National Suicide Hotline is 800-273-8255. And right now, we want to bring in Nick Guta, whose wife, Heidi Ferrer, had unbearable symptoms for over a year and took her own life in May. At just 50 years old, she was a screenwriter for the TV show Dawson's Creek, the mother of a 13-year-old. Nick, gut-wrenching. We're so sorry.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
Well, and Diana of the Survivors Corps called us last week and said this man wants to tell his family's story. What were her symptoms? What was her condition?
Well, a pain in her feet and the sort of classic COVID toes, which a lot of people had back then, we thought was just plantar fasciitis. So we went to a podiatrist and he said, I treat this all the time. I don't think this is plantar fasciitis. And he sent her to a neurologist. Her foot got so bad she could barely walk more than just downstairs in our house.
Had she already had and recovered from COVID-19? I mean, did you already know that she'd had that, or was that still undiagnosed?
So we went to get the original cheek swab test at the drive-thru, and those tests were extremely inaccurate back then. We both tested negative. And later on, she ended up getting a more specific test developed by a Stanford researcher, Dr. Bruce Patterson, who has developed some more specific tests for long haulers who didn't get a positive test early on. And her tests there were clearly definitive enough that her general practitioner was willing to refer her to the long haul COVID clinic at Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles. Ironically, that referral arrived the day before she took her own life.
Oh.
The foot pain was the first pain. She started getting very strange intestinal problems. She was getting diarrhea. I mean, she'll be mad at me for talking about that. But she was getting flu-like body aches, exhaustion, walking upstairs. She couldn't even carry a glass of water upstairs. She would ask me to carry glasses of water upstairs for anything slightly heavy I would carry upstairs for her. We had an oximeter to measure oxygen levels and pulse rate, and it would just spike like crazy.
I can't believe how long this is going on. And I know, you know, that she had a blog, her blog, Girl to Mom. Do you have a little bit there that you can share her voice?
Yeah, sure. Let me just, so this is something she wrote. I know people will die from suicide, unable to work. Some are homeless. I know some already have. In my darkest moments, I told my husband that if I didn't get better, I did not want to live like this. I wasn't suicidal. I just couldn't see any quality of life long term, and there was no end in sight.
Yeah, but then she goes on to say, hang in. You know, speaking to other people who might be having the same thing, she says, hang in. This will pass. I believe this in my bones. If you're suffering from this monster, you will eventually make it out. We will heal.
Well, you have to also understand, in the last month of her life, when neurological tremors started, they were also followed by what she described as an internal vibration in her chest that was so distracting that it kept her from sleeping. If you don't get sleep for that many weeks in a row, it's a reason they use sleep deprivation as a you know, torture device on prisoners of war.
In his study, Post-COVID Syndrome and Suicide Risk, Dr. Leon Scherer writes, there is a high probability that symptoms of psychiatric, neurological, and physical illnesses, as well as inflammatory damage to the brain in individuals with post-COVID syndrome, increase suicidal ideation and behavior in this patient population.
I'm not surprised to hear that. I mean, she said, I feel this fog, you know, coming over me. I feel disconnected. She said specifically, I feel it's crossed over into my brain. I feel pressure in my brain. When they did the autopsy, they found out that she had gotten a fatty liver from the medication she was taking and the diet she was on. A liver can release ammonia into the bloodstream when it's in that state, and that ammonia can get into the brain. If you mix the ammonia with the traditional long-haul COVID effects on the brain, you end up with somebody who's mentally not in their normal state at all. So I'm not surprised to hear his findings one bit. I think that, you know, people who have been suffering from long-haul COVID for 6 months or longer need to be extremely, extremely aware of their thoughts and their mental state, and their family members do too.
You know, there are others. The Texas Roadhouse CEO, Kent Taylor, who took his own life because it just became unbearable. And you wanted to speak. What do you want to say, first of all, to doctors?
Well, the first thing I want to say is when people come in who are presenting multiple symptoms that appear to be long-haul COVID and they haven't had a positive test, assume they have long-haul COVID. It's really, really, really important for their psychological health that people listen to them and believe them. When people feel gaslit, it makes them feel even more alone. And I just think that everybody in Washington is put their head in the sand about this, but this is a tidal wave that's coming. It's a tidal wave. The second step would be advise them on the types of medications they can take, but monitor them extremely carefully, specifically their liver function. Some of these medications can be extremely hard on their livers. When these people come in, and if they've been struggling for months, get them mental health support immediately, and that their families be aware that they're at increased risk for suicide right away. They're already in a state of physical exhaustion. As my wife said to me in the last month of her life, something that just broke my heart, as the neurological tremors started, she said, I feel like I'm a robot that's malfunctioning. And it was hard to argue with her. She had burning in her lungs when she tried to sleep at night. Her heart, you know, the circulatory system were haywire. She literally felt like every single system in her body, including her brain, was just short-circuiting.
What would you want to say to the long haulers who believed her, that she was going to make it and they're going to make it?
Well, I think that anybody out there who's suffering from long-haul COVID, you know, if you're really, really struggling right now and you need somebody to listen, you can reach me at her blog, which is girltomom.com, and I can refer you to people who can help you. In the last week or so, I've been in contact with some of her friends on her support groups who have been getting new medical treatment, specifically at the NIH in Bethesda. And there are some promising new therapeutics that I was just informed of by one of her friends, which is, of course, very bittersweet for me to hear because, you know, this is only a month after it happened and I had told her. I really think that the medical establishment is starting to focus on this and just hang on. And that's my message. Just hang on. If it comes out in the next few months that there's some serious breakthroughs, I mean, you know, obviously I'm going to be happy for everybody who's going to benefit, but it's going to haunt me for the rest of my life.
Well, and this may be too tender. What would you want to say to her? What are you saying to her?
Well, I mean, I talk to her all the time. I ask her for help. I know the pain and the suffering she was in, and you know, I don't judge her for what she did. I know what it took for her to feel that way. I watched it happen, and she really got to the point where she couldn't go on. I can't live in the past. I'm just really just trying to honor her spirit now.
Nick Gutta, his wife Heidi Ferrer, took her life in May after suffering for more than a year with severe post-COVID symptoms, leaving Nick and their son. Nick, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And again, the National Suicide Hotline is 800-273-8255.
Earlier this month, United Airlines triggered a wave of nostalgia when it announced it would buy 15 supersonic jets, a throwback to the days of the Concorde, when New York to London took just 3 hours. Here's a promise from a British Airways ad in 1976.
The world is about to become a smaller place.
But sonic booms, safety, and environmental concerns grounded commercial supersonic flight. And today, U.S. companies that are intent on bringing it back say they've addressed some of those issues. David Schneider from IEEE Spectrum reports.
In 1947, test pilot Chuck Yeager made history when he broke the sound barrier in the Bell X-1, an experimental rocket plane. Next year, another test pilot will exceed the speed of sound in another experimental plane, NASA's X-59 Quest. Quest being shorthand for quiet supersonic technology.
Well, I used to joke that the airplane looked like an F-16 on steroids, but it's a long airplane. I think it's around 97 feet long.
That's NASA's Dave Richwine, Deputy Project Manager for Technology on the X-59.
And the length is used to manage this the sonic boom signature.
Manage the sonic boom signature is engineer speak for making the boom, well, less boomy. Take a listen to an unmanaged sonic boom. This one from the Space Shuttle Discovery on its way to a landing, when it was something like 45 miles away and way up in the stratosphere.
And the viewers at Edwards Air Force Base have just heard the double sonic booms as Discovery passes over.
Okay, that might not sound so terrible on the radio, but a real sonic boom, which is felt as much as it's heard, is far worse. Sonic boom expert Dominic Maglieri described an experiment carried out over Oklahoma City in 1964. It was meant to gauge whether people would tolerate that much noise from the sky.
It was 6 months' worth of booms, 8 booms a day. I had it on Sundays, holidays, snow, rain, whatever. Pretty soon, they were getting thousands of calls and complaints.
But Vic Sparrow, a professor of acoustics at Penn State, says the booms don't have to be so annoying.
It turns out that most of the interest over the last 10, 15 years in sonic boom technology has had to do with aircraft shaping and trying to figure out how you could make an aircraft so instead of making an abrupt boom-boom kind of sonic boom is heard on the ground, that it would be more of a thump thump.
Sparrow is describing a strategy being used on NASA's X-59. It's being pursued, too, by a Boston-based startup called Spike Aerospace, which plans to build a supersonic jet that can transport up to 18 passengers. But the major player in this space is a Colorado-based company that goes, fittingly, by the name Boom Supersonic. Later this year, it will test a scaled-down prototype of a supersonic airliner it has on the drawing board for 2029. United Airlines intends to buy 15 of these planes and has an option for 35 more. United and Boom both say that these aircraft will fly sustainably.
Our first supersonic commercial airplane, Overture, is designed to facilitate net zero carbon travel.
That's Blake Scholl, founder and chief executive officer for Boom Supersonic, testifying before a House subcommittee on aviation in late April.
Sustainable aviation fuels, or SAF, are key to Overture sustainability. And we're designing Overture from the ground up to run on 100% SAF, enabling net zero carbon flight.
There's a couple of problems with this logic.
That's Dan Rutherford of the International Council on Clean Transportation.
Once the plane is out the door, there's very little control that a manufacturer has over what fuel is used. The supplies of alternative jet fuels are very, very small right now. The costs are quite high. And so you start to kind of put together the pieces and, you know, 5 to 7 times as fuel intensive, using fuel that is at a minimum 3 to 4 times as expensive as fossil jet, you start to have such high operating costs for those planes that it's very difficult to see them succeed in the market.
And Rutherford says eliminating just the carbon emissions is not enough.
If you look at the other emissions from supersonics that also warm the planet, these are the nitrogen oxides, the particulate matter, and the water vapor. For a supersonic operating in the stratosphere, those could be even worse for the climate, on the order of 20 times or more.
But Michael Leskinen, vice president of corporate development at United Airlines, says his company is ready for these challenges.
Look, we're committed to being 100% green, and that's across the spectrum of impacts that our aircraft have, and it'll be no different for Overture than it is for any other aircraft we choose to operate.
A half century ago, the U.S. looked at the environmental problems that supersonic transport aircraft posed. In the end, the government banned supersonic flight over land and decided not to pursue a supersonic airliner. European leaders, on the other hand, backed the development of the Concorde. But that plane ultimately proved a flop in the marketplace, making its last flight in 2003. Now it seems another generation of supersonic travel enthusiasts are once again grappling with these very same issues. For Here and Now, I'm David Schneider.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.